You're listening to a recording from MLK 50 Gospel Reflections from the Mountaintop, an event that took place in Memphis, Tennessee on April 3rd and 4th, 2018, and commemorated the tragic death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Micah 6:8. To do justice. Not simply to think on justice, to meditate on justice, but to do justice. We see that this is active. This is an active mandate. Dr. C.J. Rhodes and myself will be discussing today Following King's Dream, Reconciling Two Americas Through Economic Justice and Educational Equality. First and foremost, I want to thank everyone who came. I know that there are a lot of conversations going on right now by great communicators, and for you all to be with us is an honor, so I want to thank you for that. And I also want to thank the Gospel Coalition and the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for honoring King today. May we never forget his sacrifice or give up on the pursuit of his dream. You know, I was pleased to hear about the Dream Forward Scholarship Initiative that they announced earlier today for minority leaders. I was pleased to hear about the investment that's being made in the Memphis community by the organizers of this event and the partnership with the Memphis Christian Pastors Network. These efforts, in my opinion, signify a good faith step forward in restoration and getting towards restoration. So I'm glad they did that. And I also want to thank the organizers for reaching out to what I consider to be the progeny of the civil rights movement. Leaders like Dr. C.J. Rhodes. You all got to hear Dr. Charlie Dates, Jackie Hill Perry, and providing us with a platform to honestly address the present state of our journey towards conciliation, which is King's dream. Given the integrity and the boldness of those who were asked to speak, and I think you've seen that, it's fair to assume that we weren't invited to deliver false reports. It's fair to assume that we were not invited to deliver candy-coated accounts about the progress of race relations in the church. You can be certain that the two people up here right now didn't accept this invitation with an intent to flatter or an intent to entertain you today, because that wouldn't be constructive. In fact, we would be doing you a disservice if that's how we went about this. Now, at the same time, Dr. Rhodes and he can speak for himself, but I will say that we're not going to engage in gratuitous criticism or insults or gratuitous insults today. But we are going to challenge people because we think that type of challenge is necessary for growth. If we just glazed over the issues today and didn't really get down into what was going on, we wouldn't be doing anyone any favors. And so we want to make sure that this is a real conversation, but that it is an aspirational conversation. And I'll say this, I wouldn't disrespect, I think it's good that we celebrate Dr. King's life together. But conversely, we do have to recognize that the present moment in race relations in the church is more so a cause for concern than it is cause for celebration. Now, I wouldn't disrespect or disregard Dr. King's legacy or his accomplishments by denying the progress that's been made. There has been progress on racial issues. I think we need to recognize that. But at the same time, I do understand that much of the progress that has been made was achieved in the face of opposition from too many white evangelicals over the years. That it was achieved despite the efforts of some men who burned crosses on Saturday night and then stood behind pulpits or comfortably sat with the elders on Sunday morning without consequence. I recently found out that the cross burned on Stone Mountain in Georgia, that really reignited the Klan was set by a man who called himself a Christian minister. And I'm well aware that as I speak today, there are some Christians who zealously are defending every word and every action of our president, but have yet to mourn the death of Stephon Clark. And if you don't know who that is, you should look him up. And somehow there are believers that are interpreting the Bible as saying that the fight for justice is somehow unchristian. So because of this state of affairs, I wouldn't be able to bring a triumphant or congratulatory address to you today. I don't think it's the moment for that. And this is real for me, even within my family, and I'm sure a lot of others here can say similar things. We've seen how racism can tear apart families and set black people back economically. My great-grandfather was murdered. Willie Everett Gibney was murdered by two white men near Cape Girardeau, Missouri, leaving his young wife, 21 or 22, with two sons, to lose their home, to lose everything that they had. There was no safety net to catch them. And so in writing this, I had to deal with that. I had to wonder, what would my great-grandfather have said if he had this opportunity? I had to do that justice. And so I'm not here to be congratulatory or have some triumphant speech. But let me explain why I did come here. I came here, number one, because Ephesians 4 calls for unity in the body of Christ. And I know how much the enemy wants to separate us because he knows how powerful unity and reconciliation could be. I'm here because 1 Peter 3:9 commands us not to repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but to repay evil with blessing. I came because the gospel that I know is filled with hope and aspiration, even in the darkest of moments. I'm here because I have respect for men like Dr. Russell Moore and the stances that he's taken. And finally, I'm here because what I can glean from Dr. King's writings and his life, and I can only speculate, this is only my opinion, but I don't believe he would have rejected this invitation because he didn't agree with some of the opinions of some of the affiliated pastors or organizations. The difficulties between us make this conversation even more important. So there's been a lot of talk about reconciliation today, and that's good. We have to have that conversation. I think the majority of it has been very constructive, and so I'm glad to see that. But I pray that we don't allow ourselves to think that this can be done quickly over a hug in a conversation. Dr. King once said that rarely do we find men who willingly engage in hard, solid thinking. He said there is almost a universal quest for easy answers and half-baked solutions. And so I urge everyone here today not to cop out, not to search for easy answers and half-baked solutions, to do the hard work on this issue. King's dream was one of reconciliation, but not a cheap and superficial reconciliation, but one that changed hearts, policies, and institutions. It's that back-breaking work that we must do, and we know we can only accomplish with God's grace. And so I'm here to tell you, in no uncertain terms, that there will be no racial reconciliation without a painful racial reckoning. This means that power dynamics must be changed. Systems must be disrupted. Comfort zones must serve eviction. Stereotypes must be guillotined. Political capital must be forfeited. Privilege must be equitably redistributed. And we may have to let the dead bury the dead as we go forward and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ on this issue. Again, there can be no reconciliation without a reckoning. What do I mean by reckoning? Well, when I say reckoning, I'm talking about an accounting, a detailed examination and acknowledgement of how we got here. And not only an accounting, but an accountability. treating racism like we treat other sins. I said earlier, I hope some preachers here are inspired to go back home and have a fire and brimstone sermon, not about sexuality again, not about abuses again, but about racism. So we start treating that like we treat other sins. And also identifying and disciplining the perpetrators among us and within us. And lastly, I think it calls for real good faith efforts towards reconciliation. You see, the Bible demands that we try, that we give our best efforts and even die trying while we recognize our inability to ever make amends. Nobody in here can pay for their own sins, so I don't expect you to pay for other sins, but the Bible does tell you to give it your best efforts because that's what God has commanded that we do. So again, reconciliation is a process that involves awareness, relationship, and restoration. Now, speaking of awareness, I've learned the hard way that you cannot assume that people are actually aware of the real historical dynamics regarding race. I think sometimes we take that for granted that people know. So I want to start with a very historical perspective about economics and education just to give you, to put this into context and give you some perspective. Because you really can't divorce the state of economics and education in the black community from the injustices that we've suffered. Those who do are either uninformed or working in bad faith. These injustices have created two Americas. There's no disputing that there's been unjust enrichment between the races. There's no disputing the well-documented plots to sabotage black economic and intellectual pursuits. We can talk about the hundreds of years of free labor and how that was the core of the Southern economy. We can talk about sharecropping, which wasn't much better. And we can talk about the white mob that destroyed the self-sufficient and thriving town of Greenwood, Oklahoma, also known as Little Africa, and the Black Wall Street. This was a town filled in the 1920s, filled with black entrepreneurs. Hundreds of black-owned businesses from banks, theaters, hotels, and so on. And on June 1st, 1921, it was burned to the ground for no other reason than the envy of white neighbors who did it because they could get away with it. 300 black people lost their lives. 9,000 were left homeless. We have to understand that even after Jim Crow ended, there were ongoing, well-documented strategic efforts to hamper black progress in the areas of economics and education. In fact, the White Citizens Council was created exactly for that purpose. This was a group that was created as a response to the Supreme Court's 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision that found racial segregation in public schools to be unconstitutional. The White Citizens Council believed that black people were inferior to whites and should be separated from them. The organization was run by the white business class, and so they were supposedly more sophisticated than the Klan. The problem was that they shared the same premise and the same conclusion on race. Black Southerners who dared to train or encourage others to exercise their franchise were punished through loss of jobs, through the loss of their homes, and sometimes with death. And any white politician or businessman who supported integration would also be punished with smear campaigns and boycotts. In preparation for this conversation and for this conference, I read again one of Dr. King's autobiographies. And in his autobiography, he said that from the actions of the White Citizens Council, he learned that even a boycott could be immoral. While they often hid their hands in regard to violence, a member of the White Citizens Council was responsible for the murder of Medgar Evers. They were also responsible for creating the environment that would lead to violence. And so if I create a certain environment and then pull myself back, I'm still responsible for what happens within that environment, am I not? For over a decade, they were wildly successful and halting the deliberate speed of integration in public schools. Some Southern schools, especially in Mississippi, were not integrated until the 1970s. In fact, and this is an interesting fact I just learned as well, many private Christian schools are a product of efforts to maintain segregation. Segregationists set up these schools as an alternative to integration. And so we have an instance of where people are using the faith to cover up and perpetuate injustice. The White Citizens Council's efforts directly impacted Black people economically and educationally. The whole purpose, again, was to maintain a de facto separate but equal education system, and we've seen that just doesn't work. They also used, again, adverse employment decisions, evictions, taking the way that people feed their families away, taking away where the people house their families because they wanted to enforce their biases. These had devastating economic consequences and went on for years and years and years. The examples that I just provided with you are just a few. And we see that they had a direct and tangible impact on what was going on in society and on these two issues. But what we also have to think about is the psychological effect. Generation after generation. The feeling of powerlessness and helplessness generation after generation just doesn't go away. The idea that your labor is in vain generation after generation does not simply go away because the law changed. The thought that no matter what you did, no matter how hard you worked, no matter how disciplined you were, that you would never get ahead generation after generation has a long-term impact that still plagues us all today. Now, this is what I really want us to pay attention to, and then I will pass the mic and we'll do some question and answer. When the White Citizens Council closed up shop, or at least toned it down a little bit around the 70s or so, we have to understand that their mentality still existed. The systems that they had set up still existed. The advantages that they had stolen still existed. Their leaders were still the leaders in business, community, and politics. They still existed and they still led. And so the disparities that they fought so hard to maintain still exist. They don't just go away. And that's why we talk about systemic racism. It's not something that goes away because someone doesn't use the N-word in public anymore. It has a lasting effect, just like many other things have a lasting effect. Listen, if we can claim, again, that the American spirit of adventure and industry is still with us from the American Revolution, then it should not be hard for us to understand that the impact of this country's sins are still with us as well. If the positives are lasting, then the negatives can also be lasting. So we're going to get into some solutions as well. I really believe that the church must take the lead as this country's most important mediating institution. Churches must make real efforts to repair economic and educational wounds, direct efforts. And I'll give you one example before I sit down. I'm on the board of an organization called PAW Kids, P-A-W Kids, PAW Kids in Atlanta, Georgia. And PAW Kids is a product of a white and black church coming together to invest in the community. They provide summer programs, after school programs, student enrichment programs for children in an underserved area. And they also provide opportunities for Christian formation. They have done an excellent job. And what they did was go into one of the worst neighborhoods in the city of Atlanta. You might have heard of Bankhead. And they went into Bankhead and they took a trap house. A trap house is a dope house where drugs are sold in and out. They took the trap house and they really turned it into a center of hope where they feed these kids in this area. Where if this kid goes home and there's no water, he can go to PAW Kids and the kid can have a shower. Where people in the neighborhood can come and get whatever they need, whether it be tutoring or whatever. And this came from two churches coming together. It's a model that can be replicated. But Christians in here and everywhere else have to take the initiative to come together and provide these children with an opportunity that has been robbed of many historically. I believe we can do this, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you a little more today. Thank you.
Let me begin by expressing my gratitude to Brother Justin for allowing me the opportunity to share in this moment. Let me also thank the organizers, in particular Dr. Moore, for the courage and the commitment to deal with this head on. Let me say without controversy that if we're going to resolve these race issues, it's going to take white evangelicals in particular expressing very publicly what many of them say in private. And I'm thankful for Dr. Moore's courage in that manner. This morning, as I stirred and prepared myself for today, I was hit with a very profound heaviness. Didn't anticipate being so overwhelmed by this being the 50th anniversary of King's assassination and my being here in Memphis for it. And one of the things that we tend to ignore or misunderstand is that, yes, King's dream was about racial reconciliation in some sense, but it was not a reconciliation without justice. In fact, what brought him to Memphis in 1968 and what occurred before a bullet exploded his head was his standing on the side of sanitation workers who were not paid a fair and living wage. There were two sanitation workers who were crushed to death in the back of a garbage truck. And he was already in the midst of organizing what he called the Poor People's Campaign, which he launched in 1967 in Marks, Mississippi. Interestingly enough, the Poor People's Campaign was a demonstration of reconciliation, for it would gather together people across racial lines. For poverty, he understood, impacted not just blacks in the Mississippi Delta, but also whites in Appalachia and brown folks in barrios in the West Coast. And so I hope that when we leave here from Memphis today or tomorrow, that we do not simply think about the ways in which reconciliation must occur interpersonally. That is, I, a black man, engaging in conversation and relationship with you, a white woman. But that we begin to think very clearly as evangelicals, as Orthodox Christians, about not only the sins that happen intra and interpersonally, but the systematic sins in which we move and breathe. And so as we talk about reconciling two Americas, one of the things, of course, that comes to mind is a message that King preached at Stanford University back in 1967. In which he gives the description of these two Americas. Quote, there are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for situation. And in a sense, this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds, and freedom and dignity for their spirits. Tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. This other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily and search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions. They find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Justin talked about some of the things that happened post-1970 in Mississippi. I was born in 1982. That makes me an old millennial. And by the time I was born, even though desegregation was taking root in Mississippi, the rise of private schools, Christian academies, essentially thwarted the efforts of desegregation and integration. Thus, all of my education from kindergarten to 12th grade was essentially segregated education. There were no white students in my school except for the so-called white trash students who were not good enough for the academy. My graduating class included a population of about 97% African Americans, about 2% white, and then other being Hispanic. And one of the things I understood about these two Americas is that growing up in the railroad town of Hazelhurst, Mississippi, there was indeed a division across the railroad track on Extension Street were wonderful big homes, well-manicured lawns, all kinds of activity, all kinds of business. But on the side we lived in, it was indeed all kinds of poverty. We lived on that side not because my family was led by uneducated parents. My dad was an attorney trained at Ole Miss Law. But because he chose to do civil rights law and not corporate law, it meant that if he were to be on the side of the impoverished, he would in many ways bear the brunt of that, being blackballed in many ways. So 1982 through 2000, I grew up on the other side of the tracks, in that other Mississippi, in that other America. And by the time I got to Ole Miss as an undergrad, the realities of that tension and division and how it showed up in the distinctions between educational opportunity and exposure were deeply revealed. I think as we think through King's legacy for us, especially as it regards economics and education, we've got to take very seriously not just interpersonal, intrapersonal issues, but why is it the case that large numbers of people who are even millennials are growing up in segregated schools? That even today, there are hand-me-down books and teachers who can't afford enough for themselves, let alone to buy uniforms for students because their parents can't afford them. I want to share a few quotations from Dr. King about education in particular before wrapping up my comments, because one of the things that King does in his commentary on education is helps us to understand some of these realities in a very deeply historic way. On March 14, 1964, Dr. King accepted the John Dewey Award from the United Federation of Teachers and delivered a speech that included this quotation, quote, "For most of the past decade, the field of education has been a battleground in the freedom struggle. It was not fortuitous that education became embroiled in this conflict. Education is one of the vital tools the Negro needs in order to advance. And yet it has been denied him by devices of segregation and manipulations with quality. Historically, to keep Negroes in oppression, they were deprived an education. In slave days, it was illegal to teach a slave to read and write. With the ending of slavery and the emergence of quasi-freedom, Negroes were only partially educated, sufficient to make their work efficient, but insufficient to raise them to equality. It is precisely because education is the road to equality and citizenship that it has been made more elusive for Negroes than many other rights. The walling off of Negroes from equal education is part of the historical design to submerge him in second-class status. Therefore, as Negroes have struggled to be free, they have had to fight for opportunity for a decent education. The richest nation on earth has never allocated enough resources to build sufficient schools, to compensate adequately its teachers, and to surround them with the prestige our work justifies. We squander funds on highways, on the frenetic pursuit of recreation, on the overabundance of overkill armament, but we pauperize education." End quote. The last quote I want to share comes from a speech he delivered on November 13th of the same year. And there he was addressing the Association of Political Scientists and stated, quote, "Education is a primary concern of the civil rights movement, for nothing is more important to the consolidation of social change than adequate education." In places like Mississippi, where I'm from, We're fighting just to preserve adequate, not excellent, education. And it is the preservation of inadequate education that continues to frustrate the ability for the church and the larger community to be reconciled across the races. Now, Brother Justin talked about some of the devices that were used in this nation to deal with these issues. And I want to highlight one particular anecdote. Following the Civil War, Mississippi legislature passed the 1868 Constitution that promised fully funded tax-paid education for all citizens, regardless of race, from ages 5 through 21. By 1875, those white mobs that he talked about, among white Democrats, the KKK and others, began to disband a lot of the progress made from 1868 to 1875. By 1890, many of those white supremacists emerged and became the political leaders of the state of Mississippi. And in 1890, they passed a new constitution. But this time, they no longer allowed for fully funded education for all citizens. They created a separate but equal education system. And one senator who would later become the governor of Mississippi by the name of James K. Vardaman said, "Let's make no qualms about it. The reason why we passed the 1890 Constitution was to abolish the nigger from politics." So he understood that the stuff put into the 1890 Constitution would eradicate political progress, and the main way to do that was to stop fully funded education. Because if you keep people undereducated and uneducated, you keep them as a cheap labor force that can never emerge to the fullness of their potential and creativity and human flourishing. And I think if we're going to talk about reconciliation, we've got to ask, how do we see the dignity in one another such that every man, woman, boy, and girl, regardless of complexion or color, can live out the fullness of their destinies and, in the words of Dr. King, be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin? Amen. And so this reckoning that Justin talked about has to include evangelicals, white, black, brown, yellow, red, dealing very deeply with the systemic issues, not only of yesteryear, but that linger today in many of our states, our counties, our cities and towns, where education has been used as a political football to keep us divided and some of us in second class status. Thank you.